Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Illinois, offering financial products and services created specifically for the cooperative's member owners to meet the needs of rural America, including farm real estate and operating loans, crop insurance, point-of-sale financing, and risk management options, helping farm families succeed today and tomorrow.
From the Land Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the closing market report for the 10th day of July, 2018. I'm Todd Gleason. Coming up in this half hour, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Wayne Nelson. He's at L&M Commodities in New Market, Indiana. Wayne today will go on his own just a bit. As I'm traveling, he'll bring you the numbers from the CME Group in Chicago on how things settled, and then a quick bit of analysis. Otherwise, we'll take a look at the story of corn. We started that history yesterday, and we'll begin the history of the story of soybeans today. Oh, and we'll talk with Jim Dixon. He's a farmer in Idaho Falls and raises barley for Anheuser-Busch. As you know, I'm headed out to Idaho Falls this week, and we'll come to you from a remote there on Friday. But in the meantime, I need to travel across Illinois and Iowa and Nebraska. Friday, I'll probably update you on what I've seen. And of course, you can follow my Twitter account at Commodity Week to see all of those updates as well. But today we'll hear from Jim Dixon and the kinds of things he does there in Idaho Falls. That's in the valley in the midst of a series of mountain ranges. It's a high desert. I think you'll find it of great interest in how he has to use water. Please do stick around for this Tuesday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. It's public radio for the farming world.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
There are a couple of items that I think you probably should put into your travel calendar for the summer. In Monmouth, Illinois, on the 18th day of July, that's a Wednesday, your opportunity to visit with the folks from Crop Sciences, including the brand new entomologist, Nick Sider, the new plant pathologist, Nathan Klicheski. You can also learn about weeds and how to control them, and check out a wood chip bioreactor and how to use that. That's all in Monmouth on the 18th day of July. And then a bit later in the summer, on the third Thursday of August, Agronomy Day is right here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the U of I. That'll start early in the morning. I'll be there. Agronomy Day again, the third Thursday of August, that's the 16th, and then the U of I's Crops Field Day at Highland Community College way up north in Freeport is coming up too. That's on Wednesday the 29th, and Celebrate Food and Ag Day is coming up on Saturday, September the 8th. That's the football game, the Illini versus Western Illinois University. All of those details can be found at willag.org. Let me take a moment now to thank you for listening to our ag programming. Thank you. I mean it. Really, thank you for listening to the programming. And just as a reminder, here's what you hear each and every business day. We start at 8:55 a.m. with the opening market report, including Aaron Curtis, Pete Manhart, Bill Gentry, Ellen Dearden, and Bill Mayer. And then an update at 10:58 a.m. with five other voices, Joe Vaklevic, Greg Ginder, Merrill Crowley, Chip Nellinger, and Steve Georgie, followed up at 12:58 each and every business day with Sue Martin, and then, of course, the closing market report, including our analysts Kurt Kimmel, Wayne Nelson, Jackie Vakes, Dan Zwicker, and Mike Zuzalem. And we wrap up each week by recording Commodity Week on Thursday evening. You can hear it at willag.org that night, or on Friday afternoon at 2:36. Oh, and don't forget that we also have a whole series of regularly scheduled analysts during the closing market report for weather. Those include meteorologist on Monday, Mark Russo, Tuesday, Don Day, Wednesday, Drew Lerner, Thursday, Mike Tenora, and on Friday afternoon, both Jim Angel and Eric Snodgrass. WillAg.org. We think it's one of the most comprehensive places that you can find information about markets and weather and agricultural news. Oh, and thank you. Thank you so much for listening.
Since 1985, Stuart Peterson has offered strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks. The firm develops dynamic strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is available at stuart-peterson.com.
Go! Good afternoon. This is Wayne Nelson with L&M Commodities in Newmarket, Indiana. Then we're going to start today with how the markets closed in Chicago. September corn today closed at 347¾. That was down 6¼. December corn closed at 360¾, and that was down 6¼ also. The August beans today closed at 855¾. That was down a quarter. November beans closed at 871½. That would be down a half. The September wheat closed at 492. That would be down 15½. And the December wheat closed at 510. That would be down 15 cents. As we look at the August cattle today, August cattle closed at 105.45. That would be down 65 cents. And the December cattle closed at 112.17, down 77½. The hogs today, August hogs closed at 69.77½, down $3. And the December hogs closed at 50.47, down 207½. So the markets closed all down across the board. Taking a look today, the grains, of course, had a rough day. It was mainly because the weather forecast changed a little bit. We're going to be cooling off one day sooner. Instead of hot through next Monday, looks like that's going to end on Sunday, and we'll bring a little cooler weather and chances of rain in next week. The wheat ratings were very high last night, and that, of course, caused wheat to be down sharply today. Of course, we closed down 15, but we were down just about 17 to 20 all day through the day, and that pulled on the corn. The strong dollar didn't help any of our markets as far as things go that way, so that was a little pressure also. We've got a report coming up on Thursday, which is going to include how we think the exports are going to be changing because of the tariffs. So people are a lot leery about that and looking at that. Crude prices were strong, but the corn ratings were 10% ahead of last year for the same time in the last year. So, you know, we're looking at a little bit of pressure all day long here. We did make a new contract low in the East corn today, and that, but we did come back and close above that, and looks like a fairly good close in the corn and the beans for how we traded all day. So I'm Wayne Nelson of L&M Commodities, and I'll be back next Tuesday. Thank you very much.
Yesterday afternoon, the United States Department of Agriculture released the weekly crop progress report. It shows as of Sunday, 37% of the corn crop across the nation has silked. The rolling five-year average is 18%. 54% of the crop is in good condition, 21% excellent. That's down one percentage point from the previous week. 47% of the soybeans are blooming, 27% is the rolling five-year average. 11% of the soybeans are setting pods, 4% the rolling five-year average, 55% of the beans in good condition, 16% in excellent, and that's the same as the previous week. The soft red winter wheat crop is now 63% harvested. The rolling five-year average is 61%. Here are the state statisticians with updates from their regions.
This is Ben Torrens, agricultural statistician for the USDA NASS Upper Midwest Region Field Office. Warm weather and drier conditions allowed Iowa farmers 4.8 days suitable for field work last week. Activities for the week included herbicide and fungicide applications, detasseling of seed corn, and harvesting hay. Some fields remain ponded and have struggled to drain in the more saturated northern two-thirds of the state. In south central and southeast Iowa, topsoil moisture supplies remain one-third to one-half short to very short. 35% of the corn crop is silked, 8 days ahead of both last year and the five-year average. 78% of the corn crop was rated in good to excellent condition. 46% of the soybean crop was blooming, over 1 week ahead of the average. 7% of the soybean crop was setting pods, 3 days ahead of last year and 6 days ahead of the average. 76% of the soybean crop was rated in good to excellent condition. 97% of the oat crop is headed, with 51% turning color, 2 days ahead of the average. 78% of the oat crop was rated in good to excellent condition. Heat and high humidity have been hard on livestock, but cool overnight temperatures have helped reduce stress. For the USDA NASS Upper Midwest Region Field Office, this is Ben Torrance.
This is Mark Schleusener, state statistician for Illinois with the USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service. Above normal temperatures continued in Illinois last week, but only 1.2 degrees above the 30-year average. Rainfall was slightly less than average last week in most locations. Central and eastern areas had slightly above normal precipitation. There was an average of 5 days suitable for field work around Illinois last week, and topsoil moisture supplies were rated 1% very short, 11 short, 80 adequate, and 8% surplus a little drier than 1 week ago. Wheat harvest is nearly finished at 92% complete, compared to 94% 1 year ago and 84% for the 5-year average. Corn is now silking on 76% of acres in Illinois, up 36 points from 1 week ago, and well ahead of the 5-year average of 32%. The condition of the Illinois corn crop was rated 5% very poor to poor, 14 fair, and 81% good to excellent, slightly worse than 1 week ago. 64% of soybean acres are now blooming, compared to 29% 1 year ago and 26% normally. 21% of soybean acres are now setting pods, compared to 3% normally at this time. The condition of the soybean crop was rated 8% very poor to poor, 20 fair, and 72% good to excellent, a little worse than last week. This has been Mark Schleusener with the Heartland Region, Illinois Field Office of USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service in Springfield.
This is Dan Loftus, state statistician for the USDA NAS Minnesota Field Office. Scattered rain along with saturated soils and standing water limited field activities for many. There were just 3.7 days suitable for field work during the week. 8% of the corn crop was in the silking stage, that's 3 days ahead of average. Corn crop condition decreased slightly with a rating of 79% good to excellent. 32% of the soybean crop was blooming, that's 3 days ahead of last year and 2 days ahead of average. Soybean condition also decreased slightly from last week and rated 75% good to excellent. Spring wheat headed reached 92%, that's 9 days ahead of average. 11% of the spring wheat crop was coloring, 1 day behind last year and 2 days behind average. Spring wheat condition rated 85% good to excellent. Oats were 97% jointed, that's 3 days ahead of average, with 85% headed. That's 3 days behind last year, but 2 days ahead of average. 15% of the oat crop was in the coloring stage, that's 2 days behind average. Oat condition rated 79% good to excellent. The barley condition rated 82% good to excellent. For the USDA NAS Minnesota Field Office, this is Dan Loftus.
For University of Illinois Extension, I'm Todd Gleason. Well, today we'll begin a three-part series on the history of the soybean. In part one, retired University of Illinois plant geneticist Ted Heimowitz takes us back more than 3,000 years to when Chinese farmers first adapted a wild relative of the bean to cultivation. Well, the first written record of the soybean dates to the 11th century BC. The plant originated in the wilds of modern-day Laos, Cambodia, and Vietnam. From these points it spread, first to China in the north, says University of Illinois plant geneticist Ted Heimowitz. There, Chinese farmers adapted glycine soja, or the wild annual soybean, for cultivation.
So the farmers of China took this small, black, wild annual and domesticated it. When I say domesticate, what I'm referring to is just two traits they selected for. And those traits were simply upright plants. The wild soja is prostrate, recumbent, tends to trail, climb. And the second was, once it was prostrate, straight up, erect, we could then select for large seed size.
Well, those two traits mark the only real difference between the first domesticated soybean and its wild ancestor, and it happened about 3,000 years ago. It wasn't until the 20th century that the next real evolution of the soybean occurred. With the mechanization of agriculture, farmers and soybean breeders quickly realized another third trait had to be added to the soybean. It shattered at maturity, and this was bad. Farmers needed to be able to harvest soybeans without having them pop out of the pod before they could be put into a machine.
So that's the third trait occurred and that was due to the thrashing mechanization that the farmers did not want in the United States, bring the soybeans to the thrashing floor, and it would just be a mess. So selection occurred for soybeans that did not shatter. And in a line called CNS, Clemson Non-Shattering, that trait of not shattering was incorporated into all soybeans, commercial soybeans now grown in the United States and elsewhere.
So domestication of the soybean started about 3,000 years ago. The first written records come from the 11th century before Christ. The bean is derived from a wild annual called Glycine soja that looks a bit like a morning glory. It's a viney plant that climbs and trails and produces small black seeds. It can still be found today. This plant was domesticated by Chinese farmers who made it stand upright and increased the seed size. And then, just prior to the middle of the last century, U.S. farmers added a third trait. They bred the soybeans so that it would not shatter at harvest. We're now joined by Jim Dixon. He is a barley farmer from Idaho Falls. As you know, I'll be in Idaho Falls at the Barley Growers event later in this week. Part of that is because my daughter works for Anheuser-Busch and Busch Ag as a barley agronomist, and I'd like to go see her from time to time. She's actually out of the Moorhead and Fargo, North Dakota area. However, she will be traveling to Idaho Falls, and I'll be there as well. The Barley Growers event is a pretty unique event where Anheuser-Busch invites all of the barley growers, and sometimes they can be some great distances from the malting plants in, to talk to them a little bit about some of the varieties they're working with and developing. And they also, of course, talk to them about Budweiser beer and other beers that they produce. I know that from Fargo, North Dakota, if you buy a Busch Light, you're guaranteed to be using a barley that was produced in North Dakota. Jim Dixon, do you know what particular brand of AB InBev beer might come out of the fields you produce?
You know, I really don't. I think most of it probably goes into Budweiser and Bud Light. I would probably guess Bud Light. I know they blend a lot of barley.
So let me talk to you a little bit about what you do there. You're a barley farmer. I'm going to guess both wheat and oats as well. Are there any other things that you do on the farm?
It's primarily barley. Have just a small amount of wheat. We grow alfalfa and potatoes. Have a few cattle.
Why are you involved with Anheuser-Busch? What's the relationship?
It's been a good relationship. Just we raised barley from other breweries years and years ago. And they just kind of left the area, and Anheuser moved in, and we raised seed for them, plus commercial barley, and they've been a real good partner.
So there are two malting plants there in Idaho Falls. They're now both owned by Anheuser-Busch, the larger one, which is a Budweiser or Anheuser-Busch malting plant, and the smaller one, which they've just purchased in the last year or so, I believe, that was owned by Modelo. And they work in two sort of different ways. I don't know whether we'll talk about that maybe at the end of the week when we have some discussions with the plant managers there. But do you grow out different seed varieties for the two different plants very much?
No, I haven't been involved with Modelo probably for about 10 years now. Just one major variety this year for Anheuser-Busch. It's a Voyager, and I will raise some registered and certified seed for them this year.
Is part of your operation to develop seed for, or at least to grow out seed for Anheuser-Busch?
Yeah, I've been in the development stage raising breeder seed for them, and of course sometimes that works out to be a commercial barley for them, and sometimes it doesn't. But right now, it's just this year in particular is just a straight seed raising project for them.
How did you end up in Do I call it the valley there? I don't know what you would refer to in the middle of the mountains there in Idaho Falls.
Well, my grandpa came here from Nebraska in 1906, I think was the first year he farmed. I'm fifth generation, my son's sixth generation here on the farms. So that's how we got started.
So that's some kind of history. Do you ever go back to Nebraska, and are you envious, or do you think you're in a better position there?
I've only been to Nebraska once. They advertise this as a high desert with good water, and it is. We're blessed with good snowfall in the winter and a good river that runs through here, so we're pretty blessed.
Are you mostly rain-fed, or are most of the acres irrigated?
Everything that we farm's irrigated. It's all surface water. There's a lot of farms around here that use well water. For me, it's all surface water. It comes out of Snake River.
It would seem that would be a big expense year in and year out to try to make a farm profitable, especially when you're growing barley and wheat, because they're not extraordinarily high-value crops.
You're right. Of course, the groundwater people have a lot more expense than we do with electricity bills. We run about, I imagine it's close to $60 to $70 an acre for electricity. And then we're real reasonable on our water cost. It's probably runs around $10 to $15 an acre.
Then is that because you have a water allocation? That would not be something that producers here would be familiar with.
Yeah, we have it's an irrigation district where I'm in, and the actual water goes with the ground, but they charge you a fee every year. It's a tax, and that helps the irrigation district maintain the canals and cover expenses.
Is there also an allocation? Are you capped on the number of gallons you can use?
Yeah, it's usually an inch an acre. The irrigation district owns some storage water, but it's usually just water rights is the majority of where our water comes from.
It's an inch an acre for a week?
Per day.
Oh, per day.
Correct.
Okay.
So if I have if I have 80 acres here, it'll take 80 inches of water. I can use that every day. And on dry years, they might cut us back because we're running out of storage or something, but normally, we have enough water here.
And how many inches would you put on a crop in a year?
Well, that's a pretty good question. I water about five times. It'd probably be, I imagine it'd be close to 20 inches of water a year on a barley crop.
Interesting. I'm really looking forward to being on your farm. You're going to host the event for myself, the media,
correct,
and others on Thursday evening. I bet you've been busy cleaning a machine shed out or something along those lines, or you have some work yet to do, I suppose.
You know, Anheuser-Busch has came in and washed the building. It's ready to go. I haven't done a lot. We keep our farms trimmed up and on usually two-week basis, so it isn't too bad. I've done okay.
And when will barley harvest this year be?
You know, I imagine be the first week of August. We'll get started. Starting to ripen pretty quick.
Jim, thank you so much. We appreciate you taking the time with us, and I look forward to being on the farm next week and meeting you in person.
Yeah, me also. I'm looking forward to the whole event.
Jim Dixon is a farmer in Idaho Falls, where he raises barley for Anheuser-Busch. I'll be on his place on Thursday evening of this week. I'm traveling, of course, today, but we'll come to you from the Barley Growers event in Idaho Falls at the Budweiser Malting Plant on Friday. I'm looking forward to that. Hope you are, too. In just a couple minutes, we'll be back right here on Illinois Public Media with more of the Closing Market Report.
It's National Pino Colada Day. On this day in agricultural history in 1720, Mrs. Clements invented a method of preparing mustard flour or powder, which was known for a long time as Durham mustard. Up until then, mustard was made into balls with honey and or vinegar and then mixed with more vinegar when needed. Mrs. Clements extracted the full flavor of mustard seed by grinding it in a mill and then using similar processes used to making wheat flour. In 1930, the highest temperature ever recorded in the U.S. was in Death Valley, California, 134 degrees Fahrenheit. In 1920, Edward H. Lull was born. He invented a new kitty litter in 1947. Before then, ashes were often used, but left sooty cat prints all over the house. Lull filled 10 brown bags with absorbent clay, called Fuller's Earth, and labeled the bags kitty litter. The rest is history. 7 decades later, his company was the largest U.S. producer of cat box filler. In 1989, Mel Blanc died. Blanc was the man of 1,000 voices, including Bugs Bunny, Tweety Bird, Porky Pig, Daffy Duck, and Sylvester the Cat. By the way, Blanc was allergic to carrots. What's up, Doc? And in 1999, Aaron Bunny Lappin died. Lappin was the inventor of whipped cream in an aerosol can. And that's This Day in Agricultural History.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Illinois. Since 1916, Farm Credit Illinois has been helping farm families succeed, providing farm real estate and operating loans, crop insurance, and point-of-sale financing. Through both the prosperous and challenging economic cycles of agriculture, Farm Credit will support rural Illinois today and tomorrow.
In the 1840s, there were about 250 varieties of corn. They originated in Virginia, Tennessee, and Kentucky. As farmers in these states began their movement north and westward into Indiana, Illinois, and Iowa, they brought those crosses with them. 40 years later, in the 1880s, these producers had adapted the 250 varieties to the local conditions in the states across the Midwest. It resulted in 1,000 locally adapted open-pollinated varieties of corn. In 1888, Iowa, for the first time ever, raised more corn than any other state in the Union. The extra 750 varieties of open-pollinated corn, says retired corn breeder Forrest Troyer, were more drought-tolerant and shorter-seasoned than the original 250.
Out of those 1,000 varieties, I don't know the exact number, but there were probably 20 or 30 varieties that were grown much more than the others. One thing that contributed to that was the corn shows.
One of the most popular varieties was called Limming. It was developed about 40 or 50 miles northeast of Cincinnati, Ohio, in Wilmington, and had won a corn show in Paris, France. It was the first widely adapted variety of yellow corn. Half of all the yellow corn grown in the U.S. was at one time Limming corn. It actually represented just 1/4 of the total U.S. corn crop, because 50% of the corn grown in the mid-1800s was white dent corn, not yellow dent corn. Well, the next big variety was to become the foundation of almost all of today's hybrid corn. It was called Reed's Yellow Dent. Troyer says Robert Reed developed the variety by accident when he moved from Russellville, Ohio to Delavan, Illinois. In that first year, he planted and saved back seed from a variety called Gordon Hopkins corn. It had been planted late in the season. The following spring, he planted the Gordon Hopkins corn again.
He didn't run a germination test, and he got a field of corn where the stand was too good to tear up, but it wasn't as good as it should be. So he went in and he hand-planted what they called a common early yellow flint that was grown in the area. And because the early corn was planted later, they crossed. And then over a period of at least 40 years, Robert Reed and then later James Reed selected Reed's Yellow Dent.
It became very popular after winning the corn show at the Chicago Columbian Exposition. Troyer says because of the win, farmers oftentimes called Reed's Yellow Dent World's Fair Corn. A Perry Holden, head of the agronomy department at the University of Illinois, evangelized Reed's Yellow Dent, and he convinced the Funk Brothers of Bloomington, Illinois to start producing and selling Reed's Yellow Dent. Holden later took a position at Iowa State University and took 600 bushels of Reed's Yellow Dent with him. Troyer says some Iowa seedsmen were not very happy about the introduction of an Illinois corn in their state.
It soon replaced a lot of the varieties that were formerly in Iowa.
Reed's Yellow Dent and livestock feeding trial studies from the University of Wisconsin and Purdue are the major reasons U.S. corn farmers abandoned white corn. By the way, most of the 1,000 original pollinated varieties developed and grown in the Midwest were white corn. The university studies proved pigs grew faster when they ate yellow corn. It was because yellow corn provided a good source of vitamin A, and white corn did not. This one attribute, vitamin A, eliminated the majority of the genetic material farmers and corn breeders would work with to develop hybrid corn in the 1920s and 30s. For University of Illinois Extension, I'm Todd Gleason.